forgot what button to push, but figured it out. Okay, good morning, everybody. This is BioQ 31, Human Anatomy Lecture, Thursday, June 18th. And so far, everything is looking pretty good. Here is the sign-in sheet. Please make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. That is your receipt that you're here in class. That's really good when you do that. Let's take a quick look at the schedule to see how we're doing. So we said today's the 18th. Got a second lecture on tissues. Probably will take the whole time. And then next week, we've got a lecture on the integumentary system, which is skin and accessory structures like hair and nails and glands and stuff like that. And then on Tuesday, lecture on bones and skeletal tissue. And then on Wednesday, right after that lecture on bones and skeletal tissue, is your first lecture exam. And that is going to cover chapters 1, 2, 4, 5, and 6, but not chapter 3. All right, so these are the page numbers in those chapters that you will find most helpful. But if you're going to prepare yourself really well for the lecture exam, what is your approach? What should you do? What should you do? I mean, reading is important and looking at the figures. Most important thing, be really familiar with a study guide. That's right. That will really focus your attention onto what figures are important, what questions are really good, and especially the online questions, the very last web page before the quiz, the weekly quiz that you have to take. Right? Those are all interactive exercises, so you can submit that quiz and it's graded for you right away and you get feedback. And so that's really good when you get feedback before you take the test, and not get feedback as you're taking the test, right? So if you have feedback before the test, then you can go back and study something or make corrections in what you're studying, and so that is the most helpful thing to do, right? So look at those study guides. Most people print them out, but if you think really well in a computer, looking at a computer screen, you don't even have to print them out, right? But they're there if you want to do that. All right, so does anybody have any questions regarding Blackboard, your website, and what you should be doing for lecture? Okay, no questions so far. I think after mousing around a couple days and coming to class a couple days, you'll get a sense of how what the flow of the class is. But I know for a hybrid class, it's the first couple days, you probably have to put a little bit more time in compared to an on-campus class. But once you see where all the resources are and how to get to them, I think you're going to love them. Right? That's going to really help prepare you for the practicums and for the lecture test. Right? And you still have to learn a few things about Blackboard because we haven't talked about all those, but probably in lab I'll start showing you some stuff. Okay? But for lecture, you're doing pretty good. Right on. So, does anybody have any questions regarding material that we talked about last time? We started histology, we did some histology in lab, and we're going to continue looking at histology in lab today as well. And so it's going to support what I talk about in lecture really nicely. It's going to be kind of just hand in hand. You'll see that the lab manual basically is just a repeat of what is in your textbook. Right? The lab manual is just an outline of all the sections and the important exam figures that are in the textbook. So there should be a really nice one-to-one correspondence. Okay, so I'm going to put the schedule away. Don't forget, next week on Wednesday, lecture exam. Next week on Thursday is the practicum. And I can talk more about the practicum. You met Jessica a couple days ago, and she stopped by yesterday and was in that study room. And a number of students went in, spent some time with her. That is fantastic because she has a lot of experience in this class and microbiology and physiology, so she can answer questions from students, all those different classes, including ours. She's really, really good. So I would definitely stop in that study room today after class, even if you only have a couple minutes, right? And maybe ask her a question, introduce yourself, get to know her. Because after today, I'm not sure she's going to be in the SEM building. She just might be over in the LRC, which is on the bottom floor of the library. But I'm going to try to get her to come to our lab class a couple times, especially before practicum, to help work with students, because it's really difficult for me to get around to everybody. Okay? And it's really helpful if an instructor can come by and talk to students. That's really, really helpful. So don't be shy. If you have a question in lab, just raise your hand and I'll get to you as soon as I can, right, in lab. Okay, so that is all I want to say about that. And I'll put her contact information in Blackboard. The little slip of paper, I'll just take a photograph of it, put that in Blackboard so you have the phone number and an email address. Okay, so let's get started with lecture. Over the weekend, I'll build the web page where I'm going to put these lectures, the recordings of the lectures. They're not up there just yet, but they will be so that you can listen to them over the weekend. Maybe I'll do that tonight. All right, so, one last comment about the lectures. You probably can stream them off the web, but the best thing, I got to tell somebody about that projector, but the very best thing to do is to download them and put them on your hard drive and then open up a plug-in, a media player, and play it from your hard drive, because we don't have streaming web servers right here. Things are going to hang up if you try to listen to the lecture off the web, so download it. And for a PC, how do you download a file on the internet to your hard drive? What's an easy way of doing that? Anybody know an easy way? It's a command you do with your mouse. What do you do with your mouse? Usually when you execute a link, it's a left click with your index finger. But if you want to have another window pop up and give you a whole bunch of other options, you right click. Right click, a window will pop open, and depending on your browser, it will say save link as, save target as. Click on that one, and then define where you want to put it on your hard drive, right? So you might even have a folder for summer anatomy class. It's probably a good thing to do, okay? Just stick it right in there. Okay, so that's how you would listen to the lectures, once again, and also watch videos that I produced for lab, and maybe there's a couple for lecture as well. Okay, so let's start with histology. And histology is the study of tissues. What's the building block of a tissue? What's the building block of a tissue? It's a cell. That's right, a cell. And what's special about a tissue? It's a group of cells, but what? Tell me something about those cells.
Have a specific
function. Yeah, the cells have a specific function. So what does that mean in terms of anatomy? If they have a specific function and they have all the same kind of function, what can you tell me about the anatomy of those cells? Yeah, they have the same look to them, right? They have the same shape. So the structure is the same of those cells, right? So you should be able to go back and forth with anatomy and physiology. If you change one, you change the other. And what determines physiology is the structure. The structure of something is the basis of what its function is, right? Okay, so anybody remember how many general types of tissues we have in the body? There's only four. That's right. I see it on the slide. Epithelium, connective tissue, muscle, and nervous tissue. We were talking about epithelium. Epithelium covers a surface in the body. It could be an outside surface or it could be an inside surface of something. That's the job of an epithelium. And epithelium also makes glands. When we get to skin, I'll show you some glands, and you'll see that it's just a special case of the covering of a surface on something. Okay, epithelium. You know, we talked about classification by shape and by layers. We didn't get to glands just yet. All right, but let's take a look at the slide that I have up here at the moment just to review a little bit. All right, so here I see one row of cells, this top row, and it's labeled epithelium. And the basal surface is the deep surface on this particular cell, and the apical surface is right up against this space over here, which could contain a whole bunch of different kinds of things, but not part of somebody's body. It could be, like, for instance, air on the surface of your skin or blood inside of a blood vessel. And I'm glad that's not the picture slide that I'm showing. Right, maybe I'll have to go to one projector if that's going to keep flipping on and off like that. All right, so the apical surface is up over here. The basal surface is here. When you first start to look at a slide, maybe the first thing that your eyes should be attracted to or should find is this basement membrane. And Then count the number of layers of cells from the basement membrane all the way to this apical surface, and then that will determine how many layers there are in this particular epithelium. And the one we're looking at, how would you classify this epithelium by layers? That's just one way that we would do it. But by layers, what would you say? Simple, because it's just one layer. Okay, and if there's two rows of cells, one on top of the other, then what would we call that? Stratified. And then if there are 10 rows of cells on top of each other, what would we call that? And if there's a million rows of cells on top of each other, what do we call that? That's still stratified, right? So simple is just that one fundamental case where there's one row. Another characteristic of epithelium, which will be important to contrast with connective tissue that we're going to get into right away, is that the cells are very close together. There's very little extracellular space, or if there's any at all, in an epithelium. So that will be one way that your eye will be able to see what an epithelium is compared to some other kind of tissue. Okay, so that is epithelium. Good orientation to epithelium. Let's start by looking at, this cell right here. Where's this cell right here? Let me show you where it is. Okay, so here is a nice micrograph. A micrograph is just a picture of something as you're viewing it through the microscope. Right? It's a photograph of what you see through the microscope. And I see the basement membrane here. It's been cut off a little bit, but I can still imagine exactly where it is, and it's even labeled right here. So here is the basal surface of this epithelium. Here's the apical surface, and this apical surface is pretty fancy. What do you see on this apical surface? Yeah, cilia. It's not flat and smooth, but it's cilia, and the function of cilia in one word is motility. Perfect. Okay, so these things are sweeping debris out of our trachea, which is our windpipe, all the time, up into our mouth. But the dust particles get trapped in mucus, which is a layer of that fluid-like material on these cilia. And that mucus comes from this cell. This cell is what we call a goblet cell. Maybe you found some of these in lab last time, but they don't pick up very much stain, right? So stain turns something dark. It could be a dark blue, dark purple, or whatever, right? But since the goblet cell doesn't pick up stain, it just is a very bright signal that you're looking at. So it kind of stands out when you see it underneath the microscope. That mucus is in all these little vesicles right here. It does not absorb stain, so it just stays very, very transparent. So this is a cell that secretes mucus onto the apical surface. And what generally do we call something that secretes a product someplace? What would you think about? What would you want to classify something that's a cell or a tissue or an organ that secretes something outside of itself? Yeah, gland. That's really good, right? So this goblet cell is an example of a gland because it's producing mucus and secretes it onto the surface right here. So it is a gland. And the interesting thing about this goblet cell is that this is just a single cell. So this is a unicellular gland. Most glands are not unicellular. Most glands have thousands of cells that make them up. Right, so here is just a nice, really special case of a gland. So let's take a look a little bit more detail about this mucus cell. All right, and here is a nice micrograph through an electron microscope. Here is the illustration. Let's take a look at the illustration. Here are all these secretory vesicles that are going to make their way to the apical surface and secrete mucus onto the surface right here. And that mucus is part protein and part sugar. Right, and so part of it comes from rough endoplasmic reticulum, and then from rough endoplasmic reticulum, those proteins are transported to the Golgi apparatus. And what's the function of a Golgi apparatus? Two words is a good synopsis of what a Golgi apparatus does. Modification and packaging. So it takes those proteins from the rough endoplasmic reticulum, right, and it adds a sugar molecule to it. So mucus is part protein, part sugar, and that's what gives it its characteristics, which is what? Really slippery and kind of sticky too. Okay, so I can see a nice Golgi apparatus over here. making this final product. So here is that goblet cell, which is a unicellular gland. That's what we want to say about that. Okay, here's just another picture of a goblet cell illustration. Okay, other kinds of glands. And when we think of a gland, there can be basically two different kinds of glands. We want to classify glands as either being exocrine or endocrine. Exocrine or endocrine glands. Those are the two main classifications. And the distinction between them is actually fairly simple, so that's really nice. It's easy. An exocrine gland has ducts. For instance, like a sweat gland. There's a gland in your skin that produces sweat, and then when it does, that sweat goes into a tube, and the tube carries it to the surface of the body. Right, so that's what I mean by a duct. Right, it's just a tube. What's the inner space inside of a tube or a duct called? The lumen. Right, the blood vessel has lumen. These ducts from exocrine glands have lumen, and this is what carries products from sweat glands right to the surface of your body. Here's another example. The pancreas has an exocrine function. It produces digestive enzymes. And what do you think would be a good idea for those digestive enzymes that the pancreas makes? Should the pancreas just secrete it into the extracellular fluid around these cells, or should it secrete these digestive enzymes to a tube that carry them to your digestive tract? Would a tube be beneficial? And why do you think? Why do you think the pancreas, in terms of when it makes digestive enzymes, it just doesn't release the digestive enzymes outside the cell into the interstitial space? Sure. If you secrete a digestive enzyme right around the cell, those enzymes could actually digest the cell that produced them. Right? So if that was the case, then the pancreas would digest itself, and that's terrible when that happens. Right? That happens with pancreatitis, pancreatic cancer. And so those things are really dangerous situations because the pancreas then starts to digest itself. And you really need that pancreas. Okay. So those digestive enzymes are transported to the digestive tract where they work in a proper fashion. So that's an exocrine gland. On the slide over here, we see a number of examples of exocrine glands because how could you tell that these are exocrine glands? Here is a tube. Here's a tube. Right, here's a tube. These tubes are what we call ducts. Right, so these are exocrine glands. We're going to get back to this in a little bit after we talk about the second general class of glands, and that is an endocrine gland. An endocrine gland has no ducts. That's the basic definition. So it synthesizes a product, and it releases that product right into the extracellular space, and then it gets absorbed into a blood vessel. And when that product is in the blood vessel, where does it go? Blood. Yeah, it goes in blood. And then where does that blood go? It goes everywhere in your body, right? So an endocrine gland is going to send a signal out to your whole body, and it's distributed by your blood vessel. So it doesn't need a duct. It takes advantage of all those ducts that make blood vessels up. And it just so happens that that product that gets absorbed into the blood and delivered everywhere is what we call a hormone. That is a hormone. So an endocrine gland secretes what? A hormone directly into the blood or circulation and then is delivered everywhere in the body. Now, not every tissue can respond to a hormone. A hormone will only have an effect on a cell if that cell has a receptor for it. It has to have something that can recognize that hormone, and that's what we call a receptor. If that tissue has a receptor, we call it a target tissue, if it has a receptor. If it doesn't have a receptor, then it doesn't know if the hormone is there or not. It doesn't even know to look for that hormone. Right? Then it cannot be a target tissue because it doesn't have a receptor. Okay. So there are signals in our environment that we can take advantage of. For instance, like light. Light will shine on our body, and what do we have to have in order to perceive light? What do we have to have? How about if we shine a light on your belly button? Can you see it? Uh-oh. Are you guys asleep or what? Shine a flashlight on your belly button. Can you see it? No. Okay, where does that light have to go? To your eyes. That's right. And your eyes have something special so that it can detect light, and it is called a receptor. Right? So in order for a cell to be able to detect something outside of itself, it has to have a receptor for it. So your eyes have a receptor. And what kind of receptor are those? And just in a nice, very general sense, what kind of receptor do we have in our eyes? They're called, yeah, you could say light receptor, that's fine, but sometimes we call them photoreceptors, right? But nonetheless, the important concept there is that in order for a cell to detect something, it has to have a receptor for it. Okay? And it goes for our sense organs as well as other kinds of target tissues in the body. Okay, so let's look at some types of glands. On this page over here, I see that here is a simple duct structure. Here is just a single tube, and then at the base of this tube or bottom of the tube, there's another group of cells that can synthesize some kind of product and secrete it into the lumen, and then that lumen of the tube carries it to the surface of wherever it's supposed to go. This is what we call a simple tubular gland. And is this an endocrine gland or an exocrine gland that I have the cursor on over here? It's an exocrine because it has a duct. Yeah, so that's not too hard to appreciate. But some glands are a little bit more complicated than this because there can be branches off of the main tube. And so this is what we call a simple branched exocrine gland. And you don't have to give me any examples of where you would find these things, but just be aware that glands can take different shapes. Okay, and we're talking about those shapes right now. All right, so instead of a tube, this mostly looks like a tube, sometimes these cells at the very bottom that are secreting that product form more of a sphere or a circle, right? And that's what we're going to call an alveolus in anatomy, not just for glands, but for other kinds of structures in your body. If this thing turns into a nice circle, maybe like a balloon or something that I see down over here in this particular case, here is the alveolus secreting product into this tube that carries it to the surface of some structure in your body. This is what we call a simple alveolar gland. Right? So here is an alveolus. And then here is a simple branched alveolar type exocrine gland. Right, so can you see the difference between the simple tubular and simple alveolar type gland? Maybe a little subtle, but if you look at it a couple of times, you'll be able to tell. And physicians that can diagnose cancer, right? They can observe this kind of stuff just very quickly, very easily, very rapidly, right? And that's how they would stage a particular cancer. If it's pancreatic cancer, breast cancer, they would look at the disruption of these alveoli or of these tubes right here, and they would be able to tell what kind of cancer it is, what the stage of the cancer is. So it's pretty important to be able to recognize these things. All right, so not only can you have a simple branched tubular exocrine gland, right, we have a compound tubular. So now we have a bunch of branches feeding product into a main tube. So this is a little bit more complicated. And the same thing for an alveolar type gland. We can have a compound alveolar gland like this, or we can even have a gland that sometimes is alveolar and sometimes tubular, depending on where you look at it. Okay, and so this is called a compound tubulo-alveolar gland. So what did we do with this tubulo-alveolar gland? Right, we took two different kinds of structures, like this tube and this alveolus, and joined those two words together, but what would we have to do when we, as a matter of fact, it shows it right on this, on the label of this slide right here. What do we have to do if we're going to join two concepts or two structures together in one word? You just put an O between them, right? So tubulo-alveolar gland. Okay, so this is an exam figure. And so the difference between a tubular and an alveolar gland, that's pretty easy to see, right? And then a simple branch and a compound branch. If you look at it a number of times, I think you'll be able to appreciate that. Oh, and look, there's various colors on here, which might help you even appreciate this picture even a little bit more. Here's the color guide down over here, and you'll have to look at that yourself because I really don't know what colors those are. Okay, so these are the types of glands that we looked at. What is the simplest gland? What is the simplest gland that we've looked at so far? Okay, the simplest kind of gland. Simple, simple, simple. Not in terms of endocrine or exocrine. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Okay, but here is a simple, here's a simple tubular gland. And notice it's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, so 20, and then there's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So here's one with about 40 cells in it. This nice simple tubular gland. What was a gland that was even much simpler than this? Yeah, that unicellular gland, which is a goblet cell. So don't forget about that goblet cell. And the goblet cell produces mucus, secretes it, and that mucus does not go into the blood, which is a really good thing because that would plug up a blood vessel someplace, right? So what kind of gland is that goblet cell? Since that mucus doesn't go into the blood, it goes onto the surface of something. Is it an exocrine gland or an endocrine gland? Okay, it does not secrete into the blood. So it's better thought of as a exocrine gland rather than endocrine gland. Because if it was endocrine gland, then that mucus would end up in the blood and it would cause a thrombus and prevent blood from getting to some place in your body. All right, so that's epithelium. Let's take a look at some of these slides of epithelia. We looked at some of these already and you looked at some of this stuff in lab. So one of the first things that you want to be able to identify is that basement membrane. Right? I see these cells are all tightly packed together, so that's a good indication that it's an epithelium, and we see that it's forming a tube. And then I see this very small dark line ringing the tube. That is the basement membrane. So here is the basal surface. I can see the lumen of this tube, so I can see the edge, the top edge of these cells. That's what we call the apical surface. And then I can count, very easily count, how many cells from the basal region to the apical region. I just see one cell. So this is a simple epithelium, and the shape of that cell is cuboidal. So it's a simple cuboidal epithelium. Okay, here is one. Here's a basement membrane. Here's the lumen of this particular tube. Here is a cell. Basal surface, apical surface, I only see one cell. So again, this is a simple epithelium. And the shape of this cell right here is a column. So it's a simple columnar epithelium that is making this particular tube. And we got billions of tubes in our body, right? So that's important to look at these different things. Now this tube is going from right to left. That previous tube that I looked at, this nice circular one right here, is a tube that's going in and out of the plane of this particular image. All right, here's another epithelium. Here is the basement membrane. It's a ciliated epithelium, and these cells at this apical surface are columnar, so it's a ciliated columnar epithelium. And in some locations, this columnar cell goes all the way down to the basement membrane, and in other locations, I can see 1, 2, 3, 4 cells, which means that in some locations, it's stratified, so we call this a pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium. Okay, so what am I pointing at right here? What does this look like? Basement membrane, connective tissue down below it. These are all the cells that make up the epithelium. And from the basement membrane to the apical surface, you see how many layers? You can just say many. You don't have to count them, but you see many, many layers right there. So this cannot be simple. This is definitely a stratified epithelium. And then by shape, we look at the apical surface, not the basal surface, and the shape of these cells are, yeah, flat or squamous. And if you say squamous, that's even better. That's the proper term. So here's a stratified squamous epithelium. And you're really familiar with these cells because we actually got some of these cells from you and looked at them in the very first lab, right? These are cheek cells or buccal cells. All right, next one. Ah, what does this look like here? What's the general structure that we're looking at here? It's a tube. Right, it's a tube. It's not going straight from right to left. Right, it's not going in and out of the plane. Here's some orientation of a tube that is angulated a little bit. It's partially going right to left. It's partially going in and out of the plane of this image. That's why it looks like an oval. And I see the basement membrane. I see some connective tissue down underneath it. And here is the lumen of this particular duct. And here's a nice lead line that shows that. So from the basement membrane to apical surface, I see two layers of cells. So this can't be simple. It is a stratified, right? And looking at the shape of these cells right here, they look like cubes, so this is a stratified cuboidal epithelium. Okay, so on a practicum in lab, right, I know you guys don't have microscopes at home, so when I'm going to test you on being able to identify various tissues, especially for the epithelium, these are the pictures that I'll put on the test, on the practicum, right? You won't have to look through a microscope to see these things. I'm basically sent this JPEG out to Sam's Club, and they made a picture for me, and I've erased these labels right here. So anytime you have a slide like this with these lead lines, these are the things that you have to know. Be able to tell me what kind of tissue it is, right? And then this lead line, where is it pointing to? That's how you would prepare for a practicum, okay? All right, so let's have a duct right over here, cuboidal cells, basement membrane, nice. Because everybody has these pictures to prepare for the practicum coming up. All right, here I see another epithelium because here is that free space with no cells in it. Here's the apical surface. Here is that basement membrane. And what are the shape of the cells on this apical surface? Yeah, they're columnar. And how many layers do you see? More than one. So this is a stratified columnar epithelium. And then down below it, take a guess of what kind of tissue is this down below it. That's going to be, oh, it says right here. Yeah, you got to know that because it says right here. That's a connective tissue. Connective tissue because it's going to attach this epithelium to other structures in your body, like bones and muscles. Right. So if this is your skin, this is not a good example of skin, but let's just say that this epithelium is skin. There has to be connective tissue underneath it so that your skin is attached to the rest of your body. So it's just not floating around on the surface of your body. Right. So that's one way to think about that connective tissue right there. Then here is kind of an atypical epithelium. I know this is epithelium because the cells are packed closely together. I see this free space, right? So here's the apical surface. I see the basement membrane with some connective tissue underneath it. And this is not a simple epithelium, but it's really special. When I look at these cells on the apical surface, they don't look like squamous cells. They don't look cuboidal. They don't look columnar. They kind of look like big pillows, right? And when you see this kind of characteristic, you're going to recognize this to be an epithelium that's lining a bladder, like the urinary bladder. And so this is a special shape-shifting kind of epithelium. It can stretch and then it contract again, just like what the urinary bladder is doing all day long. So transitional epithelium. And I think that's the last slide for epithelium. Indeed it is. Okay. All right, so what is our next tissue that we want to look at? Connective tissue. All right, so here's connective tissue. So connective tissue, some functions of connective tissue. It holds cells and other kind of tissues together, kind of acts like glue. It has an extensive extracellular material. So where do we find that extracellular material? Outside the cell or inside the cell? It's outside the cell, right? And we got a couple general kinds of connective tissue, and I'm going to show you some examples of these things. All right, cartilage, bone, and even blood is a connective tissue because blood, since it flows, it can connect all the different parts of your body together. All right, so there could be a gland in your pelvic cavity that sends a releases a hormone into the blood. The blood carries it to your brain, and so blood helps connect that gland in your pelvic cavity to your brain. Right, so that's why blood is a connective tissue. Let's look at the slide on the right. Here is a nice illustration of a typical kind of connective tissue. And here is a cell. I see the nucleus right here. It has a bunch of these little projections we call processes that come off. So here's a cell. And then where's another cell? Here's one way over here. Okay, and so there's a big space between these cells. Let's go back to the first one. Here's a cell, and where's another cell right above it? Oh, look, it's way over here. Are these two cells touching each other? There's a big space between them, right? So it can't be epithelium. Here is a blood vessel. Here's a capillary. So if there is a blood vessel going through a particular tissue, can it be epithelium? It can't be. So here's a couple ways that we could see that it is not an epithelium. All right, and so this is a connective tissue, You can see that it has various kinds of cell types by shape, right? So all these cells have a little bit different function, but there is a lot of extracellular space. If we look over here, I don't see a cell anywhere, right? So I'm outlining a region right here where there's no cells whatsoever. So that's a pretty good indication it's a connective tissue. This space outside of cells is so important in a connective tissue, we give it a special name. We call it the matrix. All right, so the matrix in a connective tissue is really what gives that particular connective tissue its special properties. It's not necessarily the cell, it's all the junk that's outside the cell that determines what the function of that particular connective tissue is. All right, so when I look at this matrix outside of the cell, generally speaking, I see two different kinds of areas. I see these thread-like materials. These are what we're going to call fibers. And I see 1, 2, 3 different kinds of fibers right here. And then here is an area that doesn't have a fiber in it, but it has a modified protein with some glucose added to it. Glucose is a sugar, and it acts like a sponge. Okay, what would you use a sponge for at home? What would you use a sponge for? Like to soak up water, for instance, right? So you can take a dry sponge, put it on some water, and the water, right, gets soaked up into that sponge. And that's what the job of this ground substance is. It's like a sponge. It just absorbs water and holds water in the extracellular space. These fibers right here are actually what connect and give this connective tissue its physical properties. And I see 3 different diameters of these fibers. I see a thick one, I see one that's not as thick, all right, and then I see one that's really, really thin. So there's 3 kinds of fibers, or there can be 3 kinds of fibers in a connective tissue. This big, thick one right here is what we call collagen. Is that on this slide anywhere? Yeah, collagen fiber. Collagen fiber is extremely strong. If you pull it from end to end, it doesn't stretch, okay, and it's almost impossible to damage, unless you get into like an airplane accident or a big car accident or something. Okay? Collagen fiber is really, really strong. It doesn't stretch from end to end. You could think of it maybe as a steel cable or even something stronger, like a Kevlar thread. Okay? It doesn't stretch, so it really holds things together very nicely. If you pull it from side to side, though, I can see some layers in this collagen fiber. Then you can damage that collagen fiber if you pull it from side to side, because you can get separations within this fiber. But pull it from end to end, it's almost impossible to damage. This next biggest one is not nearly as strong, but it has another really good property to it. This one does stretch. If you pull it from end to end, it does stretch. And then when you let go, this fiber goes back to its original length. And I'm sure you're wearing some clothes that have something that's very similar to this, and that would be called elasticity, right? So this is an elastic fiber. It can't resist pulling or stretching, but when that force is released, then that tissue goes back to its original location. And could you give me a demonstration on your body right now of a tissue that has elastic fibers in it? Could you give me an example that has elastic fibers? Okay. Think of something that you can stretch or change the shape of, and when you let go, it goes back to its original shape. Yeah. Like your elbow right there? Yeah, your elbow's got some elastic fibers. That's right, because it stretches and goes back. Right? Those muscles can stretch, and then when you relax them, they go back. Here is another really good example that's not a muscle. Okay, it's your ear. Bend your ear, and if I let go, what's going to happen to my ear? Can you see my ear? Somewhere people in the front can. If I let go, what happens to that ear? It just flips right back to its original position, right? Your nose, okay, your ear has elastic fibers in it. They're not really strong. However, if you overstretch an elastic fiber, then it can be damaged. And sometimes boxers, if they get hit in the ear repeatedly and they get bent and pushed and pulled in all kinds of different directions, what happens when their ear heals up? It becomes deformed, right, because these collagen fibers are not put down in the exact location they were before, and it becomes what we call a cauliflower ear, okay, when it gets rebuilt. Okay, so our ear doesn't have much in the way of collagen fibers, has elastic fibers. All right, so that's two. The third one is a reticular fiber. And what can you tell me about the strength of this reticular fiber? Because it's really, really thin. It is really, really weak as a result. Reticular fibers are the weakest kind of fibers in a connective tissue. They barely hold something together. So we find reticular fibers in places in your body that don't experience a lot of stress or tension or twisting or anything. And a really good example of an organ that has reticular fibers is the spleen. Spleen has reticular fibers, and maybe you're kind of aware, right, if you have any trauma to your body, the spleen can be damaged very easily. Even though it's deep inside your body, it can rip apart pretty easily. And these fibers are so weak that if a spleen rips apart, you can't even sew it back together. As soon as you put a suture in the spleen, it rips more of these reticular fibers and then produces more bleeding. Right, so if a spleen gets damaged, that part of the spleen just has to be removed. Otherwise, somebody can bleed to death. Right, so reticular fiber is very weak. Elastic, a little bit stronger, but they're stretchy. Collagen fibers don't stretch. They are the strongest fibers in a connective tissue. All right, well, these fibers just don't appear by themselves. They're secreted by a cell. This collagen fiber is secreted into the matrix, right, by a cell. And I see it right here. Can you see this cell secreting this protein? Collagen is a modified protein. This cell is what we're going to call a fibroblast. Fibroblast, that's easy to remember, because what does a fibroblast secrete? It secretes fibers. That's generally what it does. Okay. All right, so this is a really nice example of a general kind of connective tissue, a big space between cells. That space is what we call. Anybody remember what that space is called? Yeah, the matrix. Okay, and it's extracellular. Matrix can have two different kinds of things. It can have ground substance, which is like spongy material, and fibers in it. Okay, so that's a connective tissue. Let's take a look at some particular kinds of connective tissues. We're going to skip this one. Ah, here's one that looks very much like that illustration that we looked at. Okay, so if you look at this one right here, I see some really big, thick fibers. What are these big, thick fibers called? Yeah, that's collagen. And then these others over here are elastic fibers, and I don't even see any reticular fibers on this particular connective tissue. Okay, so no reticular, but I see big, strong ones like these Kevlar cables right here. That's collagen. And then here's a nucleus of a cell that is secreting these fibers into the matrix. This would be a nucleus from what kind of cell? A fibroblast. Okay. So I got a question for you. This is the nucleus where I have the pointer. Is the nucleus an organelle or is it a cell? Ooh, good question. Is it an organelle or a cell? Yeah, it's an organelle. It's just part of a cell, right? So if there's a lead line, like pointing to here and to here, and the question is, name this cell, what would you want to say? Would you want to say nucleus? No, because nucleus is an organelle, right? So if there's a lead line here and the question is, name the cell, what would you say? Not nucleus, because that's an organelle. You would have to tell me the name of this cell, which is a fibroblast. Yeah, so always read the question, okay? So that's just to make sure that you guys know the distinction between an organelle and a cell. Okay? What's the relationship between a cell and an organelle? What's the difference? What's the difference between a cell and an organelle? Yeah. Organelles are a building block of cells, right? Think of that hierarchical organization of things that we looked at. In order to make a cell, you need organelles. Right? Organelle is a building block of a cell. A cell is not a building block of an organelle. Right? A cell is a building block of a tissue. Okay, so think of that level of organization. I'm going to come back to that one. These are reticular fibers. Right? At pretty high magnification, over 500 times magnification. And reticular fibers stain very, very dark. Right, but when I see the pattern of a reticular fiber, it's highly branched and it's twisted. Sometimes we might want to call that convoluted. So this is a typical look of a reticular fiber, staining really, really dark and all kinds of branches and twists and turns. And you would find that, for instance, in the spleen, reticular fiber. All right, let's take a look at this one. Here is a fibroblast, and the nucleus is stained really, really dark. And then here is another fibroblast way over here. So could this, and this is all extracellular space, could this be an epithelium?
No,
because there's a huge matrix. There's a big separation. And I see big, strong collagen fibers in the matrix. And all these collagen fibers are going in the same direction from right to left, right to left, right to left, right to left. This is what we added. They're very dense, so this is dense regular connective tissue. Regular because collagen is going only in one direction. Dense regular connective tissue is what makes tendons and ligaments up. So tendons and ligaments, like this tendon right here, attaching your scapula to this, probably a biceps brachii right here. This is dense regular connective tissue. If you pull it from end to end, it's very strong, very hard to damage. But if you twist your shoulder, for instance, it can separate and can be damaged in the middle, right? You can have a separation. So this is a tendon. A tendon is a muscle to bone connection. I see some more dense regular connective tissue, but okay, I can see, and you guys will be able to see in a little bit, that here's a bone and here's a bone over here. So a bone to bone connection is called a ligament. Ligament, bone to bone, tendon, bone to muscle. But that material is all the same. It looks like this underneath the microscope, dense regular connective tissue. This material that's surrounding the joint, okay, has collagen going in all different directions. There's still a lot of collagen, so this is pretty tough material, but not as strong as dense regular in one direction. It's kind of strong in all directions, and that's what I see here. I see fibroblasts, and here are some collagen fibers. Here's a bundle of collagen that is going in and out of the plane that we're looking at. Okay. And then here's collagen fiber that's mostly going from right to left. All right. And then I maybe can find some that are angulated. So here collagen is going in all different kinds of directions. So dense irregular connective tissue provides resistance to stretching in all directions, but is not quite as strong as a tendon or a ligament. Okay, here's another kind. This one is similar to this one, which is similar to this one right over here. They're different magnifications, so sometimes it's kind of hard to appreciate. Right? But when I take a look at this kind of connective tissue, I just see like these little bubbles all over the place, just a random arrangement of these things, and it just looks like a speckle pattern, has a special speckling look to it, as opposed to when we looked at this areolar connective tissue. When I look at this, right, okay, I see something, it reminds me of something. Does this areolar connective tissue remind somebody of anything? Have you seen anything like this in your everyday life? Maybe kind of loosely associated with something you see? You want to know what I see when I look at this slide? Might help you remember what it is. I see a stained glass window, right? So I see like a little window pane here, glued to another one here, another one over here, all these little patterns and sharp angles. Kind of reminds me of a stained glass window. And you might see other colors in here. You might see yellow from fat cells. And probably you might see blue or pink or purple. I'm not sure what these other things are. But that kind of reminds me of a stained glass window. As opposed to this one right here, I just see a speckle pattern. This is a characteristic of cartilage. Cartilage is a connective tissue. Here is a little hole in the, so this is all matrix, right? Space between cells. Do you see any fibers in this matrix? It looks all the same, right? So this is what we're going to characterize as hyaline cartilage. Doesn't have much in the way of fibers. It's mostly ground substance for holding water. Okay, so here we have some hyaline cartilage that make up extensions of your ribs that go over here to your breastplate or sternum. And this kind of cartilage also covers the ends of bones that join each other, like joints in your shoulder and in your knee and your hip. And since it doesn't have fibers to it, do you think it's very strong or is it pretty weak if it doesn't have fibers? It's weak because it doesn't have fiber. So those cartilages in your knee and in your shoulder and various joints throughout your body can be damaged pretty easily as a result of that. Okay, and I don't see any blood vessels in here. Without blood vessels, then this tissue can't heal itself. It can't repair itself very well. So cartilaginous injuries, right, are very persistent. You don't recuperate from them hardly ever. And so that's why if there's damage to cartilage in various places of your body, they just have to remove it and hopefully not make the joint any worse. So here is a bubble in the ground substance. This bubble is what we call a lacuna, right here. And here is the cell inside of the lacuna, which is secreting ground substance into the cartilage. And it is called a chondrocyte. What kind of cell secretes a fiber into the matrix? That's a fibroblast. This one right here is a chondrocyte. Cyte just means cell. And guess what chondro means? Anytime you hear a word with chondro in it, you're going to think of cartilage in particular, right? So chondro is cartilage. So here is a chondrocyte. And here's the nucleus of that chondrocyte. And this chondrocyte lives in this little bubble. That bubble is what we call a lacunae. And everything out, what do we call all this stuff outside the cell? Matrix, right? Weakest kind of cartilage. Right? But actually, that's not a bad thing because it's very light. This kind of cartilage is very light, so we don't have to expend a lot of energy to haul it around with us all day long because it is so light. Again, I kind of see a speckle pattern, so I recognize this to be cartilage. I see lacunae. I see cells inside the lacunae, so these are all chondrocytes, right? But now in the matrix right here, right, I see some ground substance, but what else do I see now, just generally speaking? I see some other structures in here. These are fibers, right? Can you see these fibers in this particular picture? Right, and these fibers are highly branched. They're pretty thin. These are elastic fibers. So this is that kind of cartilage, right, that you can deform, you can twist it, you can stretch it a little bit, say bend it, and when you let go, it goes back to its original condition. And demonstrated that already. Elastic cartilage is the kind of cartilage that makes up your ear and other kinds of parts of your body. Like when we swallow something, this epiglottis right here is working. It bends and then it flops back to its original shape. Okay, so elastic cartilage. That's a little bit stronger than hyaline cartilage. We got one more kind of cartilage. Again, I see a speckle pattern. I see a lot of matrix. And now take a look at these fibers. They're very big and strong, oriented in one direction. This is the strongest kind of cartilage. It's not elastic. You shouldn't stretch this kind. Okay? It can be deformed just maybe a little bit. So these cells, again, are called chondrocytes. They live inside a lacunae. And this type of connective tissue is called fibrocartilage because it has these big, strong fibers in it, right? Fibrocartilage. All right, so you got three kinds of cartilage. Weakest one, hyaline. Next strongest, elastic cartilage. And the strongest is fibrocartilage. Fibrocartilage helps make up intervertebral discs in your vertebral column. Fibrocartilage also makes up the menisci in your knees. Have you ever heard of a knee meniscus? Yeah, it's a kind of cartilage, right, that's between those bones inside your leg, and you're standing on that cartilage all the time, so it's got to be pretty strong. It's made out of fibrocartilage, a knee meniscus. You've got two in every knee, so four altogether. Here is another kind of connective tissue. I see a cell here, and then way over here is another cell. I see a cell, and then way over here I see another cell, right? So it's a connective tissue. And I see some blood vessels in here. They're going in and out of the plane, so they just kind of look like circles, right? So if I see blood vessels and cells far apart, can't be epithelium, right? So it's got to be connective tissue. And when I look at this slide, there's a pattern that I see. It's really obvious to me. What kind of pattern do you see when you look at this particular connective tissue? I see people drawing. Yeah, I see what? Circles. So I see a circle here. And then on the outside of that, I see a circle. And then outside of that, I see a circle. And then outside of that, I see another circle. Right? I see rings. I see circles inside of circles. But remember, right, this right here is something that resembles a tube that's moving in and out of the plane of this particular image. So it's a tube, okay, and outside of that is a tube. Or let's start right here. Here's a big tube, big wide tube, and inside that is another tube, and inside that is another tube, and inside that is even another tube, right? And this is characteristic of bone, Okay, bone. So, and when I look at this, it can kind of reminds me of tree rings, right? If you were to take a cross-section of a tree or something, you could see the different layers, the growth rings every year that are laid down by a tree as it's growing. So this almost looks like a botany slide, but it isn't. It's from bone. And these tubes are really important because it resists compression. You can't compression is if we were to grab this bone on one end at the other and try and force those ends together. That's what we call compression. These tubes resist compression. And everybody kind of knows that. A tube is, or engineers know that, if you want something to be really strong, it should be a tube. Like when you make a bicycle, they use tubes, right? Because they don't compress. They're very, very strong. Maybe another good example is this pencil right here. What are a couple ways that I could put some stress or force on this pencil? I could take two ends, and I could try to bend it in the middle like that, and I bet I could snap the pencil pretty easily, okay, if I were just to keep pushing on the ends, right? So I could break the pencil. How about if I grab the ends again, like hold it between my two hands and try to bring my hands together, try to compress this pencil? Do you think I would be able to get the pencil any shorter if I were to push on the two ends? No. I would push so hard, it would probably just go right through my hand because this is a tube. Tubes are really strong. They resist compression. And bones are really fascinating because it's just not one tube. It's what? Tubes inside of tubes inside of tubes. And they're next to what? Other tubes inside of tubes inside of tubes. So bones are super, super strong in this dimension. Now, since this is bone, these cells right here cannot be chondrocytes. Right? Because chondrocytes are found in what kind of tissue? Cartilage. That's right. They're found in cartilage. And the word for bone, okay, in anatomy is osteo. Right? So, like that disease when people start to lose their bones, it's called osteoporosis. Osteo is bone. So these things right here are called osteocytes. What does site mean once again? Cell. Osteo means bone. Ah, look at that. It's not labeled on this slide. But you got to know what those cells are called. They're called osteocytes, and they secrete all of this calcium and phosphate and even collagen into the matrix to make bones very, very strong. Here is kind of a funny connective tissue. This is blood. Bones are real strong. They don't compress. They don't hardly move at all. This kind of connective tissue moves very easily because it's a fluid connective tissue, and this is what blood looks like underneath the microscope. It has all of these small disc-shaped cells. These are red blood cells. They carry oxygen in our body, right? And I see some other cells. This is a lymphocyte. Here is a neutrophil, and you can see the difference between a lymphocyte and a neutrophil because the lymphocyte is mostly made up of the nucleus, and it's nice and spherical and smooth. Okay? If we look at the nucleus of a neutrophil, it's a lot smaller, but it has, a bunch of lobes to it and little connections between the lobes. So the nucleus is what we call lobular. So I do want you to be able to recognize the difference between this neutrophil and this lymphocyte. And these are what we call white blood cells. They are for our immune system. They help fight infection is what their job is for, right? So immune function is what you would want to say. And can you tell that they're different from these red blood cells? Yeah, they're pretty easy to see. If you look at this red blood cell, right, something that's really strange is that I don't even see a nucleus inside this cell. I don't see a nucleus anywhere. And that's a characteristic of a normal, perfectly functioning, very good red blood cell. It does not have a nucleus. Inside the cell, there is a chemical that is called hemoglobin. Red blood cells filled with hemoglobin so that it can carry oxygen. The job of hemoglobin is to carry oxygen. So there's no room for a nucleus inside of a red blood cell because its job is to carry oxygen via hemoglobin. And because there's no nucleus, that's why the cell lives only for a very short period of time. It cannot repair itself. You need a nucleus for repair. Right? And then, here is the matrix. What do we call the matrix in blood? Is it solid like bone? No, it's fluid. The fluid part of blood is what we call, I see it right here, plasma. Right? So blood has generally two kinds of components. The fluid part is what we call plasma, right? And the solid part is what we call cells. Sometimes we call those formed elements. Those are the two main characteristics of blood, plasma and formed elements. So would you be able to see the difference between this red blood cell and this white blood cell when you look at it underneath a microscope? Yeah, you'll be able to. You have a lot more red blood cells than you have white blood cells, so sometimes you have to really look around a lot to find these, but today in lab, you'll have a chance to do that. Okay? And I think they're going to look exactly the same. Okay, so those are some connective tissues. And when are we done in here? At 9:30? Is that our time? Okay. So we get to talk a little bit, right, about some membranes. Okay. Here is your skin. Sometimes we call that the cutaneous membrane. Where are membranes? Way down, oh, right here. Okay. Cutaneous membrane. It's on the outside of your body. Okay. And when we think of a membrane, generally we think of two locations where it can be. So we give membranes a classification of being in one place or the other. The two general kinds of membranes that we have in our body is a mucous membrane, and the other is what we call a serous membrane, mucous versus serous. So what's the difference? Well, a mucous membrane is a membrane that lines a cavity that's open to the outside world. Right? So could your oral cavity, the covering of your oral cavity, could that be a mucous membrane? You would say yes, because it's open to the outside world. That's a mucous membrane. A mucous membrane doesn't necessarily have to secrete mucus, but a lot do. Okay. And the membrane on your windpipe right here, since it's connected to the outside world, that's a mucous membrane. The membrane that lines your digestive tract is a mucous membrane as well, because it's open to the outside world, right? Via your mouth, for instance, or your anus on the other end. And this kind of membrane in the digestive tract certainly does secrete mucus, okay? So that's how we would consider this, why we would consider this a mucous membrane. The other kind of membrane is what we call a serous membrane. It lines a cavity that's not open to the outside world, right? Like the pleural cavity, the pericardial cavity, the peritoneal cavity, right? These cavities are not open to the outside world, and it has a serous membrane. Serous membranes are a little bit more complicated because there's not just one layer that makes them up. There are two layers. I see one layer here, and I see a space between the layers. We got to know something about these layers. All right, so I'm going to zoom into this slide right here. Bring it on over. Okay, so here is a membrane around the heart. All right, what do we call this cavity that the heart is in? Pericardial cavity. Here are the lungs. What do we call that cavity that the lungs are in? The pleural cavity, right? And since these cavities are not open to the outside world, right, these are serous membranes. And I see two divisions of this pericardial membrane. One division is right on the surface of the heart, right? We call that the visceral division of the pericardium. And then you've got to step across the space, and then here is the outer layer. This is what we call the parietal division of a serous membrane. So there's two layers, and then there's the separation. There's fluid in this separation that we call serous fluid. All right, so visceral division is right on the surface of the organ. Parietal is across from the serous cavity with serous fluid on the inside. So let's look at the lung. I still see these two layers, right? What would we generally call this layer that's right on the surface of the lung? That is the visceral, right? Because the lung is what we call a visceral organ. It's deep inside of a cavity is what that means, right? And then the one that's not touching the lung, this is the parietal, right? So visceral parietal, same thing for the heart, visceral parietal. And the same thing for the peritoneal membrane. And there's a space, right, between that's filled with serous fluid. Okay, and sometimes you get an infection or inflammation of this space involving these serous membranes. And if it happens to the heart, that's called pericarditis. Right? Pericarditis is inflammation of this thing that's surrounding the heart, that serous membrane. And what can happen is that this space fills up with fluid. All right, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, deeper, wider, 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 deeper, and that's really dangerous. Can anybody think why pericarditis is really, really dangerous when this space down here fills up with fluid? Because when this space fills up with fluid, the heart, okay, has to get smaller because the space is going to compress the heart, right? And as the heart gets smaller and smaller, blood can't flow into it, right? So as somebody gets pericarditis, not so much blood can flow into the heart. And if there isn't much blood in the heart when it pumps, guess what? It can't pump a lot of blood. So that's a very dangerous situation, okay? Pericarditis. There is a condition, okay, where the membrane around the lungs, that pleural membrane, gets inflamed, gets an infection, and that is called pleurisy, right? And when this membrane stretches for somebody that has pleurisy, it feels terrible. It feels like you're getting stabbed in the chest, all over your chest with a knife, a nice sharp knife. Okay, so every time you take a breath, you feel like somebody's just stabbing you a million times with a knife. So what would be your first choice if you do something and it feels like somebody's stabbing you with a knife? Your first choice would be not to do that activity, right? Because you don't want to feel that pain. So you would just stop breathing. But what does it feel like when you stop breathing? That doesn't feel very good either, right? So somebody with pleurisy has two choices. Right? They can feel like they're being stabbed in the chest, or they can feel like they're choking to death. So which one would you choose? Well, you would choose neither. Both are horrible, right? Horrible. So these patients are just in misery because they don't know what to do. Should they breathe or not breathe? That's a terrible circumstance to be in. So when you have a patient that's feeling that intense pain, what can we do for somebody that's feeling intense pain like that? Just can never go away no matter what you do. Okay, what can we give a patient that is feeling that kind of pain? I'm sure you all know. Yeah, pain medication like opiates, for instance, right? So that's a perfect condition, right, when you want to use some kind of opiate to relieve that pain from somebody, and they'll be your friend for life. They'll say, oh, thank you so much, because now what can I do without pain, excruciating pain? I can breathe once again. That's wonderful when you can breathe, right? Okay. All right, so here is a serous membrane. Serous membrane also around, got to go back to this one right here, zoom in over here. What happens if I go back? Do I lose it? Okay, so here is what, the abdominal cavity? Here's the pelvic cavity. Remember, they're joined together. These cavities are not open to the outside world, so there is a serous membrane around them. And the serous membrane has got two divisions as well, right? What are the two divisions? Parietal and visceral. We said that this is the peritoneal cavity. So here is, for instance, let's just say that this is part of the stomach right here. This is the organ inside that peritoneal cavity. So here is a part of the membrane that's right on the surface of this organ. This would be the visceral division. And then here is the part on the body wall, this is the parietal division, and then here is the serous space with serous fluid inside of it. Okay, so visceral division, parietal division, and since it has those two divisions, we call that a serous membrane. Okay. And we talked about the pleural membrane, pericardial membrane, and peritoneal membrane. You can have an inflammation of the peritoneal membrane because every once in a while somebody's appendix might become inflamed and infected, and if it's not treated, it can even burst with all that infected material going into the peritoneal cavity. We would call that peritonitis, right? So these serous membranes can be infected. If somebody has a burst appendix, you can live through that, but I'm sure you're going to feel really miserable, right? It's best to get that appendix taken out. So you don't need that peritonitis. Okay, everybody sign the sign-in sheet. It went around. It's probably up at the top of the room. And we're about ready for lab. All right, so I'll see you upstairs in about a half hour or so.